Possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. Hope you'll stay with us now for an archive interview. This interview, first conducted, was conducted on January 29th of last year. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the difference class makes in the lives of working women. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments for Jennifer Johnson. Johnson, who does research and teaches at Johns Hopkins University, spent 4 years interviewing working class women about their work lives. She is the author of Getting By on the Minimum, The Lives of Working Class Women. Johnson's book examines a number of issues. Among the questions she asks, have some women come farther than others? She also tells readers in the book's introduction that class still matters and that it is important that poor and working class women be heard as they talk about what is important to them. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Jennifer Johnson. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jennifer Johnson's book, Getting By on the Minimum, is published by Routledge. Jennifer Johnson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
What led you to your interest in work, and specifically your interest in working class women?
Well, I think in part my own background, which was working class, and my experience of being a student, a graduate student, and also being, as an adult, a middle-class woman, and realizing that most middle-class men and women have very little first-hand experience of what it's like to be poor or working class. And so that really was my main motivation for going to graduate school, was to address these kinds of questions.
Hmm. You write in the book, too often working class women are viewed from a social distance and through a middle class lens that filters out differences among them and between them and middle class women. When you remove that middle class lens, what differences do you see among working class women, and what differences are there between working class women and middle class women?
That's a big question. Well, among working class women, well, let me back up just a little bit. I think that often sociologists portray working class women in a very stereotypical way, and it's often one motivated by a desire to a sympathetic orientation towards working class women, and a desire to portray them sympathetically. But I think often what it does is kind of oversimplifies the complexity of being working class, because in fact there are many, many differences among working class women. Some are the same kinds of personality differences we find among middle class women, and it's wrong to paint working class women either as saints or sinners, which tends to be the case. You know, we have welfare mums on the one hand, and then sort of Rosie the Riveter on the other. And these are equally inaccurate portrayals. But what I found to be the major difference among working class women is the difference between women who, because of their academic aptitude, because of their home situation, poverty, for a number of reasons, dropped out of school at a very young age and really spent their lives in social isolation, And there were a number of women like that in my study, and there was a qualitative difference in the quality of their lives, as against working-class women who'd completed high school and had found jobs in what I call, what sociologists call the primary labor market, that is, jobs as secretaries or receptionists for large companies with benefits. And this, what some people, I suppose, call the underclass, I don't really like that term, the women who are poor and have very little education, are really, I feel as if they're abandoned and forgotten because they often work in the corner store or just a fly-by-night factory. They have temporary jobs, and they are really often very much exploited. In fact, I've talked with women who weren't even being paid the minimum wage and who didn't get their paycheck regularly even, and it was hard for me to realize that these conditions still exist in the underground economy, I suppose you can call it. So, and in fact, I came to question the usefulness of the term working class, although I continue to use it, because in fact there is just an enormous difference within that category.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really surprised me. The stunning diversity and the stunning differences between women and the level of education, that fact, that part of the picture that is so critical, is so important in the work experience of women. What I wanted to ask you now is, you know, what can you tell us about the gap in working conditions and wages in this large group working class women?
Well, as I said, some of the women I interviewed were not even paid minimum wage. Mm-hmm. That was really a minority, obviously, but even at minimum wage, you know, that turns out to be something like $10,000 a year, which is what most public state colleges now cost for a year's tuition. And what I found to be compelling and of great concern was that poor women are usually married to poor men. And so sometimes, in fact, in a couple of cases, a family was living on that tiny income. But even if there are two, a man and a woman in a family earning something like $10,000 a year, that's still way below the median income in the U.S., which is, I think, something around $32,000. And I found many couples like that, just really scratching by in poverty. On the other hand, what's happened over the last decade or so is that earnings for professional women and men have continued to grow, while those in the bottom educational sector have fallen. So what you have then is a situation where professional families, because as you know, professional women marry professional men, and women still mostly marry up in terms of status and income. Some of these professional families are doing marvelously well. Their incomes have risen, and there are two large paychecks, while at the other end of the scale, poor and working-class families, who often are servicing the needs of the professional families, are actually just scraping by, really on a minimal income, often with no benefits. So it's almost as if the kind of situation that Marx described, you know, a century or so ago, is returning, where we just have this really sharp dichotomy.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's continuing to grow apart. So that if you just look at mean or average income, the real situation is hidden, because actually we have this divergence where some are going up and others are going down.
And with this gap in income, we could say that because of the link between poverty and the risk of dropping out, this is a very significant problem.
Well, it really is. And Baltimore, where these women live, has a very high dropout rate, and it has a very high unemployment rate. And there's been job growth in Baltimore City, but unfortunately the kinds of jobs are these low-paid service jobs, usually temporary, that result from companies outsourcing. So a major company, for example, a cosmetics company, will subcontract its work to a temp agency, and that temp agency will employ these low-skilled women. And so hand in hand with the high dropout rate goes this particular kind of labor market that actually, in a sense, takes advantage of that low dropout rate, because this having a high school diploma, as I said, the importance of that was something that I wasn't really prepared for, and women and men too, no doubt, who don't have that are really pretty much condemned to a life in this labor market that is the underside of our economy, I guess. But a point I'd like to make about education is, of course, if everyone were to finish school, high school, then that really doesn't change the labor market. So that I think that as well as tackling education, we have to tackle job conditions. In other words, there will still be people who are at the bottom in terms of education, even if they do have a diploma, and they'll still be sucked into these truly horrible jobs.
Hmm. What is the reality of going back to school or getting on-the-job training for working-class women who left high school before getting that diploma?
Well, some women had gone back to school, and there is a general equivalency diploma, the GED, that is available, and there are classes available for women to take. But it's very intimidating, especially for women who dropped out because they weren't doing well in school. I found that the women who went back to do the GED, there were only 7 of them, by the way, out of 60 or so in the sample, were women who had dropped out because they were pregnant or for some reason not directly related to school failure. And even those women were very anxious about it. They had to be persuaded by parents to do it, or by husbands, or even children in some cases. And then it is expensive. In Maryland, it costs, I think, something like $45 to schedule the test. And it's very grueling. There are something like 5 sub-tests, and I think it's held over a couple of Saturdays. And you can imagine for women who've been out of the education system for 20 years or 30 years, this is a very frightening experience. I think most, in Maryland at least, most of the people who are successful in gaining the GED are under 25, so they tend to be people who have left the education system fairly recently. And I think a problem is that there's very little on-the-job training and few opportunities for women to study as part of their job, so that women who have children and who have really grueling jobs during the day have little energy left over to go off to classes at night and try to learn. I found that very few women did that, which I think is really sad, because there's a huge waste of potential. And then also some women were very vulnerable to corrupt schools, you know, these proprietary schools that promise all sorts of, you hear ads on the radio or television, they promise all sorts of highly paid jobs for home study. And I had some women who had taken those courses and been sent out booklets where they could learn, and they were totally unrealistic, they were just exploited, and they lost their money and had no better chance of getting a job than they would have had originally. So these are generally I think the fact that women take these classes where they can study at home shows that there is really a desire there amongst these women to have a second chance and to improve their job prospects. But it's hard for them, especially when they've been socially isolated, to know the ropes and to find the free courses and face up to going out and exposing themselves publicly.
Mm. Jennifer Johnson is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Getting By on the Minimum, The Lives of Working Class Women. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I'd like to go back a little bit, backtrack a little bit, and talk about, you know, how many women you interviewed and how old they were and how you selected them. You interviewed 81 women, 63 of whom had working class origins, 18 of middle class origin. All were white, married mothers living, as you alluded to earlier, in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
How did you select these women?
Well, I was really fortunate in that a large study has been ongoing here at Hopkins since the mid-70s. This is a study of development amongst Baltimore school children. So what happened at the beginning of the study 20-some years ago was that a sample of 800 was selected in Baltimore schools. And my thesis advisor was one of the originators of this study, and she gave me the opportunity of using mothers of these children to draw my sample. The advantage of that was that often, you know, samples are selected using snowball methods, so I call you and you agree to be part of my study, and then you call a friend who calls a friend and so on. And, of course, the problem with that is people who are friends or who know each other or who belong to the same club tend to be very similar. Mm. Whereas this way I chose the mothers simply on the basis of their children having been Baltimore City school children that long time ago. And so it wasn't a random sample, but it was representative of Baltimore women or white Baltimore women. So I used those addresses and was able to draw the sample from that source.
And how did you decide if a woman was of working class origin? You said a little bit earlier you're not really comfortable with that.
Well,
but you have to make some choices.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I have to say I agonized over that for months. And there were certain women I went back and forth, because it sounds all very well in theory to talk about this class and that class, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty of people's lives, they never fit neatly into those categories. So ultimately, I decided on using women's father's occupation as their social class of origin, so that women whose fathers worked in blue-collar jobs or very fairly unskilled white-collar jobs I considered to be working class, and then women whose fathers had a college degree are considered to be middle class. And then I did the same thing for women's class as adults. I took whether they had a college degree or not as indicative of class. And there's evidence that that is an important dividing line, but more importantly from my point of view, that seemed to be the dividing line that really made a difference in terms of how women lived. So that women whose parents or fathers in particular had a college degree were living very middle or upper middle class lives as adults. And so there had seemed to be a long-lasting effect of class of origin. And there were only, I think, six women who began life in working class, defined that way, and who ended up in the middle class.
Mm.
So in other words, only six of these women actually made it to college, and finished, which was another thing that surprised me.
Mm. That really also underscores what you say very early in the book, class still matters very much in this country.
Well, it really does. And when I first came here 20 or so years ago, I was struck by how little class entered into, you know, the public discourse, because I grew up with a Labour Party and a sort of very strong union or Labour consciousness. And it struck me that that really didn't seem to exist, that there was very little class identification and that everybody claims the middle class as their own. And I actually, one of the reasons I feel a bit guilty about even talking about working class women in relation to the women I interviewed is that I suspect that most of them wouldn't define themselves that way. They would probably consider themselves to be middle class. And I think that's one of the reasons that we don't think about class very much, is because we all think of ourselves as middle class.
Hmm. What did the women say when you asked them what they liked most about their jobs?
Well, almost always it was the people at work, and that was particularly so for working class women and less so for middle class women. And I think the people at work were very important for a number of reasons. One, in unskilled jobs and jobs that may have been boring or lacked intrinsic interest, the people at work become very important because they may be the main source of enjoyment and pleasure. Also, in situations where bosses don't have many constraints on their behavior and tensions are sometimes explosive, having a kind boss or not makes the difference between being satisfied and not being satisfied. And in fact, I talk about that in the book because it seemed to me that women made themselves vulnerable by focusing so much on the quality of their relationships. Understandably, they, especially in a situation where most jobs are temporary and there wasn't much stability, they made themselves vulnerable to having their job suddenly change from being enjoyable to being very unenjoyable just because their supervisor got moved or fired or some such thing. And I cite a few examples of that in the book. And also, women would accept, I found, almost any job conditions as long as their boss was pleasant or apologetic about it, or, you know, as long as their interpersonal relations were good, they made excuses for their bosses. One woman said that although sick leave was really available officially, that they were penalized for taking it, and she justified that and said, you know, some people would abuse it, and my boss has to be careful, and that sort of thing. And there were several examples where women described how previously they loved their job, and now because of a change in supervisor or a takeover of the company, which of course happens all the time, they were absolutely miserable. So this is the problem when there aren't formal job rights, of course, that women are very vulnerable.
Yeah. There are two women that come to my mind as you were talking that are fine illustrations of what you've been talking about. One woman worked, I believe it was in a retail situation. I'm not sure, because there are so many wonderful stories in the book. But she had a change in supervisor, and his situation was such that if he could reduce the workforce, he got a bonus. And so he was doing that, and the workers were figuring, you know what, we're all on our way out of here, because what's going to happen is this guy's going to turn us all out, and then they're going to hire part-timers, temps, to do the work. And then there was another case So then there's a lot of tension between the workers. I mean, suddenly that people thing gets a little complicated, too. I go to work because I like the people.
Exactly.
But boy, you know, that is a bad situation.
Yeah, that really was. As our local grocery store now has these machines, you know, where you check out your own grocery. So I think that situation is growing more tense. In lots of grocery stores. So that was one example. And then there was another woman, Phyllis, who also, as it happened, worked in a grocery store. And she wanted to go to her daughter's graduation, I think it was, or a game. And usually she would just trade off with someone else so that they would just switch shifts and she would be able to go. But her new supervisor had told her that wasn't acceptable. She couldn't do that. And so she was just furious when I interviewed her, and I think she decided to go anyway. And she was timed on the job so that she had to check out a certain number of items in a certain time, and she'd had surgery for carpal tunnel syndrome, and her previous supervisor used to still time her but say, "Don't worry about it, I understand that, you know, you're a little bit slower," whereas her new supervisor decided to stick by the rules and not give her any leeway. So that was an example where just, you know, a change in supervisor really had changed her feelings about her job to such an extent that she was going to quit. But I think your point about the tensions not just being between supervisors and workers, but among workers themselves is really an important one to remember, because that was the case in a lot of jobs where there were these kinds of tensions. In factories where speed was important, wherever competition was introduced, that led to tensions. And that was why I think many women were not interested in being supervisors. I don't know if you remember, but there were a couple of cases in the book where women refused to be line leader because they didn't want to lose their friendships and face the hostility of other workers. So I think this is in work situations where there's a squeeze, you know, as there is with these in many of these agents or temp agencies, where women are just taken on when there's a need and then dumped when there isn't. There is, of course, a lot of competition because, you know, if the person next to me is faster, then she may be given a job again tomorrow or next week, and I won't. So that was really a serious problem.
Yeah, and also underscoring the importance of the person satisfaction, a woman's satisfaction in her job, depending so heavily on the kind of supervisor she has. There was a woman who was a housekeeper, and she worked for some priests in their parish home, and the priest that she had reported to left for another assignment, and then the guy that she had to answer to when you talked with her was really difficult. And so not only is she in a solitary, she's in a solitary work situation, so she doesn't have that people connection. But she also now, the people connection she does have is with that supervisor who's not a nice guy.
Yeah, that was, she also was about to quit her job because it had just become unbearable. She said with the last priest, because she worked in the local parish, I don't know if you mentioned that, the last priest was her friend in a way, and so when she'd finished her tasks for the day, he didn't mind if she went home because he knew she had children. And then when the new priest came, he said, "Your hours are until 5 o'clock. If you've finished your tasks, you know, strip the wax from the floor," and just refused to let her go. And then he had large gatherings at the house, and he started to insist that she cook fancy things, and she said, "You know, I don't know how to cook crab imperial," and he told her to go and get a cookbook, and she was really proud of herself because she did figure it out. But he started to treat her like a servant, and that's what she didn't like. So that was exactly the kind of situation that women were very vulnerable to, and particularly with no educational credential. I think many women already had feelings of insecurity about their worth in the workplace, and the awareness, the realistic awareness that their choices were limited, so that made them even more vulnerable to that kind of treatment.
Hmm. Another kind of work that I would like to talk with you about now is what you call caring work.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an area that is a growth area. We need more and more people mm-hmm. to take care of us. And, okay, there's a demand, and these people are very much needed, but they're not valued.
Well, that's really true. I think that's a disturbing situation that, for example, if you look at childcare, the turnover amongst childcare workers is something like 40% a year. It's very high. And the wages paid to childcare workers, in fact, you earn more to train animals than you do to care for children. You earn more as a garage attendant than you do as a childcare worker. And that is really disturbing, both from the point of view of the social justice for the women who do these jobs, but also from the point of view of the care that children are receiving. And I think, if only for selfish reasons, I think middle-class mothers should be very concerned about that. And I think there were other differences, too, that working-class women tended to do the sort of the hard, manual, dirty work of caring that women who had a choice would prefer not to do. So it's working in hospitals not as a nurse or as a physician, but as the person who, you know, washes the bodies and lifts the patient from one place to another and does the more menial work. And even outside the paid workplace, actually that same distinction arose, that working class women were often involved in very hands-on caring for children, grandchildren, parents, where they, one woman, for example, had to go to her father's house twice a week and bathe him and because he had Alzheimer's and wasn't able to take care of himself. Whereas for middle class women, that sort of caring tends to be more managerial. So there is, and of course, in a way, it's structural because it's in the interests of middle-class workers to pay as little as they can to their childcare workers or their nannies or their home health aides. And that's a situation that I think we really have to address.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, it's a growth area because healthcare workers, I think, are the largest, the fastest growing service sector, and it will just continue to grow as we baby boomers get older.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the healthcare workers, and there was a woman in the book by the name of Wanda, who mm-hmm. is a healthcare worker, and she works just from her description of her job. She works very hard, and she earns $7 an hour.
Yeah, she, that's right, she was an aide, and she didn't have, she was one of the women who completed a GED, and she really did that because she wanted to be able to get a better job within the hospital. And she talked a lot about the injustice of her wage compared with the wages of the nurses. She said at that time, you know, the nurses were paid about three times as much as she was, and she also talked a lot about the fact that she had, compared with professional staff, she had very little flexibility, and I don't know if you remember, but she was taking care of two grandchildren, and her life had just been turned around, so she really had a need to have some flexibility, and of course, as a worker at the bottom of the hierarchy, she just was told by her supervisor that she had to work the hours that she was told to work or lose her job. And she actually relished the situation when her supervisor later became a mother and needed herself to take flexible hours, and I think she felt somewhat vindicated. But she's a good example. She did very heavy, hard work, lifting very heavy patients, and also then, of course, coming home and looking after her grandchildren.
Hmm.
I think this her experience actually explodes another myth. I think many women think that the supervisors that working women have the most trouble with are men, but I didn't find that to be so. It wasn't that they were more likely to be women necessarily, but just that there wasn't any clear difference there. Supervisors were either helpful and kind and considerate or not, and it seemed to be fairly independent of gender. I think you raised a point earlier that I just wanted to return to that I think is really important, and that is that many women, the least skilled women, work in isolation. So they work in a situation maybe at a local store or as a housekeeper where they don't have other workers to share their experience and to have some sort of solidarity with, and they really do just depend on the boss for all their social contact. And I think that's one of the problems in terms of encouraging more consciousness about their rights. That is, that they're not in factories or in those traditional workplaces where union membership is a tradition and there is that kind of worker consciousness.
Hmm. You know, I had never thought of this before looking at your book, but recently I've had to do some traveling, and I've had to stay in a particular place in a motel.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep going back to that same place. It's convenient, and it's a fair price, and it's clean and whatnot, safe. I feel secure there. And you know what? I have noticed that the housekeeping staff, most of whom are women, there are a couple of men in housekeeping, but they work in teams. And so when they come in to clean your room, there are two of them, and they, while they're working, they be talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought, I don't know if management in this institute, in that place, knows that makes a difference and makes their employees happier workers, or if just happened.
That's interesting. It would be an enlightened policy if they...
It could, yeah. Was it on purpose, or
that's right.
or was it just, you know...
Or had even the women decided that, well, why don't we team up,
yeah,
and we'll still get all our rooms done and it'll just be much more fun.
Yeah, it'll go much more quickly.
That's right, yeah. Because that certainly was true. Again and again, women stressed how important that was. The friendships they'd formed at work, and often women had lived in isolation, especially women who hadn't worked before, and there were a number of those who got their first jobs in their 30s. And to actually be with other women, not just in their immediate neighborhood, was a new and wonderful experience. And even to Baltimore, I don't know if it's the same where you are, but many working class people stay not only in Baltimore, but in the same suburb or even the same block for their entire lives, and often three generations live just within a stone's throw. And so many women had lived really all their lives with very little contact with other people, even from people from other parts of Baltimore. I was surprised by that. And so to go to a workplace where there are women from all over who've had different experiences, and even to become involved in the production process, or whether it was packaging up cosmetics or doing bulk mailings for something, it was nonetheless interesting. It took them out of their usual routine and their fairly the narrow confines of their daily life, and I think made them feel part of something larger. And so even though the conditions of many of these jobs were truly terrible, I wouldn't want to sound as if work for most of these women was a horrible experience. It wasn't, in fact, and they derived many benefits from working. And this going out into the world was, I think, one of the most important ones. One woman said, you know, she was married at right out of high school, and she said she felt more independent, and it gave her more, it turned her into a stronger person, she said. And I heard that on several occasions. Another woman was severely handicapped in terms of reading, and she'd never written a check herself, and so now that she was working, her husband, she said she was going to have him teach her how to write a check. And so these are things that many of us take for granted, but they're important life skills that some of these women had not acquired yet, and working was opening the door to that. Another major benefit was driving, being able to afford a car and therefore getting a driver's license and having that kind of independence. And these were the things that women mentioned when they talked about the benefits of working.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener, a caller on line one in Champaign is waiting to talk with us this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like for your guest to address the religious background of these women and something about whether their faith was what kept them going, especially in situations where maybe they had a husband who couldn't work, but their values were very traditional, and that they knew that the husband was to be the provider and protector of the home, but they were willing to accept the fact that he couldn't do that and work anyway, even though they would prefer the other way. If there's anything on that that she could share with us? Okay.
Now, that was a good question, because, in fact, I didn't ask about religious background, in part because I think social scientists have been nervous about asking about religion. It hasn't been really at the center of our sort of conceptual world, I suppose. But I realized, in response to your question, that as I talked to these women, that for many, religion was very important. And I regretted that it was halfway through the study when this realization came to me, and I didn't feel that I could backtrack and explore it more. But I found one of the women, I think Nina, I talk about in the book, was quite poor. Her husband, a truck driver, was often unemployed, and they lived in a very tiny house, and she had, I think, seven children, about four of whom were still at home. Plus, she'd adopted or was fostering another little boy, and she gave up hours and hours of her time every week to volunteer at the local school and was paid only for a fraction of the time that she worked. And her religion had been a very important source of comfort to her. And not only that, I say in the book, it had really given her a calling. She felt it was her calling to help the children in the school, which was in a very poor neighborhood. And she herself had been abused as a child. And she specifically said that she had found religion to be a support. And demographically, Baltimore, Maryland, as you may or may not know, has a history as a Catholic state. And I think just from inferring from the number of women who talked about their priest, probably there may have been a larger than average number of women for whom religion was important. And the lesson I took from that is that it certainly would be useful and helpful to ask about that in the future.
Hmm. Another thing that struck me is the differences in values, which I don't know is linked, you could say, is linked to faith or not, to mm-hmm. religion or not. But there are differences in values, I think, between the women that you profile in the book and middle-class women.
Well, yeah, it was interesting because one of the things I was interested in addressing was this image of the working class man as Archie Bunker, you know, sitting there with a beer can in one hand and his fat belly hanging out of his trousers and his feet up watching the television. And I just really didn't think that was a very fair image. And it certainly seemed to me, from interviewing these women, now admittedly they were all women who were married, so you could argue that maybe they had exceptionally good marriages, although some were in their second or even third marriage. Their husbands, I found many, many warm, supportive relationships, and I certainly didn't find the working-class man who was refusing to let his wife go to work and who was, who fit that stereotype. In fact, it just could have been a chance thing, but I found that working-class husbands were more likely to help more with housework and childcare than middle-class husbands, in part perhaps because middle-class husbands had professional jobs and they worked longer hours. But I found that to be interesting, the number of working-class men who cooked the dinner and did the laundry and generally helped out. And I found it to be very moving, actually, the number of warm relationships that I found amongst the working-class couples.
Hmm. There is where we have to leave it because we're out of time. Jennifer Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're very welcome. Jennifer Johnson has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Getting By on the Minimum, The Lives of Working Class Women. And that interview was from January 29th of 2003. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. One quick reminder for the producers out there that on Monday, crop insurance decisions are due, and that if you need some help with that yet, I know probably there are several that are looking to make decisions. You can get some of that from the WILL website. Gary Schnitke, who puts together the Farm Doc site on crop insurance, spoke at our All-Day Ag Outlook meeting this past Tuesday for 37 minutes. All of that audio is up on the website at WILL.UIUC.edu. And you can just click on AM and then Agriculture, and you'll find Gary Schnitke's crop insurance audio, as well as a link to the Farm Doc website, and crop insurance can be found there. I would go to both of them and try to use them together if I were you. Now, let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade today for the day. March wheat futures up 2 cents at 359 on the high, low at 354, and a settlement price 2 higher at 357. May futures 368, the high, the low at 360, a settlement price 364 and a half, up 3 1/4. July futures for the wheat 370 and a quarter, high, low at 364, a settlement price at 367 and 3/4, up 3 1/4. September futures 374 and a half, high, low at 369, a settlement to 372. They were up 3 for the day. Contract December 383 and a half, the high in the wheat pit, the low at 378 and a half, a settlement price at 381 and a half, up 2 3/4. From the corn pit, futures mostly 2 higher for the day. The March futures were 2 and a half higher. They had high of 297, a low at 292 and a half, and a settlement price at 295 and one half. The May futures in the corn pit 302, the high, the low at 298 and 3/4, settled above the $3 mark at 301 and a quarter, up 2 1/4. July futures above 3 bucks 2. They had a high of 305 and a half, a low at 302 and a half, and a settlement at 304 and 3/4, 2 1/4 higher. September 298, the high, low at 295 and a quarter, settlement price at 297 and 3/4, up 2 1/2. Now your new crop, December's 295, the high there, low at 292 and 1/4. That new December settling at 294 and 3/4. They were up 2 1/2 for the day. March corn, 295 and 3/4 high, low at 293 and a quarter. A settlement price, 295 and a quarter, 2 1/2 higher. And the July futures, 297 and a half on the high, the low at 296, settled 297, up 1 3/4. December 05 contract, unchanged on the day, 266, the high, the low at 65, and the settlement price, once again, 266 there, up on the high, and it was unchanged. March, it's 155 and a half high, low at 155 and a half, and a settlement there, 155 and a half. Of course, the March contract's going off the board, down a penny and a half on the day. May futures in the oat pit, 161 and a half high, low at 159 and a quarter, and a settlement at 161 and a half, up 1 1/2 for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby March off the board at noon today, it went off 10 cents higher, 964, the high, the low at 949, a settlement price at 954, up 10 for the day. May futures, in a comparison, 959 and a half, it's now your lead option, and it was the high, the low at 944, settled at 955 and 3/4, 11 and 3/4 higher. July futures for the bean pit, 945, the high, the low at 933 and 3/4, settlement price at 941 and a half, up 7 and 3/4 on the day. September contract, 820, the high, the low at 811, settled 815 and a half. half, up a penny and a half in the November futures, 743 and a half. The high, the low at 734, settled 738 and three quarters, down a quarter. January soybeans up two for the day, then high of 739, a low at 733, and a settlement price at 738. March futures at 735, high, low at 726 and a half, and a settlement at 733. They were down one. March bean meal at 290.50 on the high, the low at 286.70, a settlement price at 290 even, up 450. The May meal up 610, 293.40, the high, the low at 287.20, settlement price at 292.70. And once again, that was 610 higher. March bean oil, 33.50, the high, the low at 33, settled 33.05, down 25. And May oil, 33.33, the high, the low at 32.72, and a settlement at 33.05. They were down 14 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Feeder cattle finished mostly higher. Everything else looks like it ended up mostly lower on the day. March feeder cattle, 89.90 the high, 89.50 the low, 89.80 the settlement, that up 35. April, 89.15 the high, 87.85 the low, 88.37 and a half the settlement, that up 40. May, 87.85 the high, 87 even the low, 87.22 and a half the settlement, that up 10. August, 88.95 the high, 88.40 the low, 88.75 the settlement, that down 7.5. March live cattle, 85.15 the high, 85.15 the number for the low in settlement, that down 30. April live cattle, 82.17.5 the high, 81.25 the low, 81.40 the settlement, that down 42.5. June live cattle, 76.47.5 the high, 75.85 the low, 75.87.5 the settlement, that down 57.5. August, 75 even the high, the low 74.35, the settlement 74.52.5, that down 45. April lean hog, 64.35 the high, 63.70 the low, the settlement 64.32.5, that up 60. May lean hog, 64.25 the high, 63.50 the low, the final price 63.92.5, that down 10. June, 70.15 the high, 69.15 the low, the settlement 69.70, that down 20. July lean hog, 66.25 the high, 65.40 the low, the settlement 65.72.5, that down 32.5. March pork bellies, 98.75 the high, 97.25 the low, the settlement 97.72.5, that down 60. May bellies, 99 even the high, 97.20 the low, 97.50 the settlement, that down 85. The Dow is up 83 points at 10,211. The NASDAQ, 30 higher at 1974. The S&P 500 is 10 higher at 1117.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Pete Hayek from San Antonio, Texas writes, "Dear Dr. Science, whenever I get upset, I always read a science fact, and that cheers me up. Sometimes it's just the molecular weight of a familiar substance, or I'll play a memory game with the periodic table. No matter which science fact I choose, I always feel better when I'm done. Have you had this experience?"
No, I'm afraid I...